Let's take a walk on the paranormal side now. Bruce Olav Solheim back with us. His latest book is called Timeless Trinity, an extraterrestrial and paranormal personal history. So I'm looking forward to that when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Dr. Bruce Olav Solheim, PhD, served in the U.S. Army. Thank you, sir. He was a jail guard and later a helicopter pilot, served and earned his PhD in history from Bowling Green State University. He is currently a distinguished professor of history at Citrus College in Glendora, California, where he has taught a paranormal personal history course since the fall of 2018. Bruce has studied quantum theory, has developed a model that may help explain our quantum reality, ghosts, reincarnation, alien contact, and so much more. He has been abducted several times, has seen UFOs, and continues to have contact with alien beings. Dr. Solheim is an associate member of the Parapsychological Association and a member of CIRO and MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. Bruce, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing well, George. Thank you for having me back, and thank you for your service, too.
Okay, and this book, Timeless Trinity, I'm looking forward to this. And you have a comic book, which we'll talk about a little bit later on, but
sure. How
did you develop that?
The comic book?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was 37 years in the making, I like to say. I was in engineering school. I thought I was going to be a petroleum engineer. I was in Butte, Montana, at Montana Tech. And I had a dream about this half-alien, half-human character who comes to Earth, and he's kind of an innocent abroad kind of a character. And
yeah.
I was drawing a comic strip. I was writing and drawing this comic strip in the school newspaper, the Technocrat, and I had about 6 issues of it that came out in the school newspaper. And I devoted so much time to it that I actually dropped out of engineering school and went back in the Army after that.
Really?
Yeah. So, and then it just kind of got put on the shelf until Christmas time, over a year ago, my second eldest son had found, I had sent him an old comic, the comic strip from the original comic,
yeah.
And he designed a 3D bust of the character and gave it to me, and that inspired me to, I gotta come out with the comic book. I gotta do this. So it was always a dream of mine to do a comic book, and finally I did.
Who's the artist for the comic book? Who does the sketches for you?
Yeah, Gary Dumm is the illustrator. He worked with Harvey Pekar and American Splendor, and he's been around since the 70s. Very accomplished, very experienced comic book artist.
And the name of the comic book is called Snark, right?
Snark, yeah, S-N-A-R-C, Snark, yeah.
Is it out on the shelves now?
It's you can get it on Comixology, and that's the easiest place to get it. Or people can just go to my website, BruceOlavSolheim.com, and they can order it that way, too.
Now, this is your third book in your trilogy of Timeless Trinity. And
I've done 3 paranormal books. The whole odyssey started, 4 years ago now. And so this is the third book that just came out. And, I'm not sure if there'll be more paranormal things keep happening. And I keep teaching the class. So, maybe it'll be more than a trilogy. I don't know. But this one is the most spiritual of the 3. It also is the one that goes farthest out, and I really don't hide anything or hold anything back in this third book. The first book was kind of test the waters, second book a little bit more, this third book I just let
you
it
just
all
jump
out.
Right in, and you've got some heavy hitters who have written some snippets: Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove, Edwin Young, Dr. Dean Radin, former Assistant Attorney General Terry Lovelace. You got some heavy hitters here.
Some of those folks were on board with it, and I think that the time is right. We see more academics coming out and testing the waters, and some diving right in. I wrote an article for MUFON about considering UFOs, whether it's considered paranormal or not. I got invited by Ray Hernandez to write a chapter in the new book with their organization, which I think is called FREE. And I think that was started by Edgar Mitchell. So, yeah, it's just once you get out there, then people take notice of, if you have an advanced degree and you're willing to talk about this, which I am. I'm about 4 years away from retirement, so I'm not really too worried about it.
Ah, you'll never retire, Bruce.
I say that, yeah, right.
Was it your abduction case that got you into this?
That was in 1964. I was 1964. I was 6 years old.
Okay.
That was the first experience. There was actually a paranormal experience before that. My earliest one at age four, but it wasn't an alien or an abduction, or as I call it, a reunion experience. But so it was really 1964 when I was 6 years old that that first happened, and it came about. Writing about this is a combination of my own personal recollections, and oddities, things that just didn't seem to add up, and then doing a hypnotic regression with Yvonne Smith, who I know you have the acquaintance.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And piecing that together, I figured out that first experience, which was in my backyard, really in my home in Seattle, in Kenmore, Washington, north end of Seattle. It was not only a contact experience, but it was also kind of a rescue in a way. It's kind of a long story, but long story short, it turned out that it was a rescue because the family that lived above us, the man there in that family, the father, was a child molester. And
oh, geez.
I believe that the alien contact saved me from that. So it's not always a bad experience with these extraterrestrials. So that's a story that had to be told, and I just waited for the third book to tell it.
Well, thank you for putting us in the acknowledgments, along with our colleague Dave Schrader, good guy, and so many other people. We're in great company with Whitley Strieber and the late Philip Corso. But thank you for that.
There's so many wonderful people. I'm on the shoulders of so many wonderful people. Trying to reach for the stars, trying to piece the puzzles to get the puzzle together,
Timeless Trinity, an extraterrestrial and paranormal personal history. Tell us about this third book.
Well, the third book has 24 stories about my paranormal experiences. So it includes the extraterrestrial alien stuff and contact, the continuing contact I have with I call him an ancient alien mystic named Anzar, which is a very interesting story. And then I have some, regular paranormal stuff. I had some adventures in Chicago that I was being filmed for a potential show about mediums and so forth. And they took me to different locations in Chicago, and I had some terrible experiences there. That wasn't extraterrestrial, but it was scary, kind of demonic stuff. And so it's a compilation of all these stories that weren't included in the first two books, plus some stuff that continues to happen. And the first book was 34 stories, paranormal stories. Second one was 31 stories, and this one is 24. So altogether, I guess that's 89 of my paranormal stories that I've put together in this trilogy. And probably that, I on the cover. If you've noticed, the cover is a very shocking picture of a reptilian female, and it was quite a shocking experience. That happened in September of last year. One of the chapters in Timeless Trinity is called "The September to Remember," and I think it was September 8th, she came to me in my dream, and it was kind of It started off as a pretty nice dream, actually. I was in a house that I didn't recognize, and my mother was there, and my mother died in 1990. So I was just having this pleasant dream of my mother,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden, and she was acting weird, though. She was acting kind of aggressive and kind of just not like my mom, kind of almost in a provocative way. And I thought, that's not how my mom acted. She was a very nice, decent lady.
Sure.
And all of a sudden, she morphed into this very bizarre-looking reptilian lady that's depicted on the cover of Trinity.
And that is a bizarre-looking reptilian, let me tell you.
Yeah, she is. And she was both alluring and frightening at the same time. And the thing that I remember most about it was she was telling me, she was kind of warning me about, that she could do whatever she wanted to with me, and she was very rough with me. What she did is she picked me up and slammed me against the wall in this room, and it was like I was a feather, to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 6'3" and about 260. I'm a big person, and she was just incredibly strong, but alluring at the same time, strangely alluring at the same time. So it was a very bizarre experience. So I I put her on the cover, and I had a couple of other experiences, at least one other experience with a reptilian type earlier in the year, or actually the year before, and it was a male, and he was outside of our house, and this is in a vision that I had, because I have these visions a lot, and down below our house, just kind of under a street lamp, if you can imagine that, on a cul-de-sac under a street lamp,
right,
looking up at me. And at first I thought it was somebody I knew. So I waved to him and said, "Hi, Bobby." I thought it was my friend Bobby. And he looked at me, and he had a very terrible look on his face. And I thought, "That's not Bobby.
That's not him at all." But did he look human?
He had a trench coat on and a hat, so that looked kind of human.
Yeah.
But I saw his face, and I go, "That is not a human face.
Oh, geez.
That is a reptilian face." So
much like what's on the cover?
Yeah.
Sort of?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, very much like that. And I'm not exactly sure what they're up to. You know, I've asked my spirit guides and advisors, and I take it that they're not happy with me. They're not happy with the comic book, because in the comic book, the reptilians are kind of the bad guys. And I'm not sure they like me talking about them either. So I think there's a little bit of that.
Yet haven't your abduction cases been somewhat interesting, I guess? Not dangerous?
Yeah, I've had two. I've had like the two rescue operations that I mentioned. The one where me and there was other children involved as well, and that was in 1964. And what happened was that my parents, the people that lived above us, they were babysitting me when my parents were away for short amounts of time, and I noticed there were other kids in the house, and the lady would leave. She had a business she ran, and the husband would stay home, or the father would stay home, and they had two or three of their own kids there, and he would do weird things, and I had these conscious memories of this. He would do things like tell us to he would go hide in a closet in the dark, and then we were to come and find him. It was kind of like a hide and seek, but we knew where he was, and then you were supposed to stay in the closet with him. And I never did it, because I thought that's just too, I didn't trust him, because he was an adult and he was acting like a little kid.
Yeah.
And it just was very suspicious of that. And he tried to give us little Dixie cups filled with an odd drink that I didn't like. I didn't like the smell of it, so I didn't drink it. But now I know what it was. It was alcohol of some type.
Hmm.
And
put you under.
So, this had happened when I was a kid. And then my brother went to a Sons of Norway meeting a couple years ago. And maybe 5 years ago, and he met the lady's sister, and he said, "Oh, whatever happened to so-and-so and so-and-so?" And she, the sister of this lady, said, "Oh, we don't talk to them anymore, because he was a child molester." So that confirmed my suspicions that this guy was up to no good. But the alien intervention was that...
It saved you.
I had two, playmates, invisible playmates, I guess you would call them, and one of them was an adult. And I always thought it was weird that one of my invisible playmates was an adult. So there was a little kid as my playmate. He was my age, and then there was this adult. Well, it turns out that adult was actually an ET, and he was helping me and guarding me from being hurt by this child molester. That's why I called the story Big Bad John, because that's what I called him, Big Bad John. But he was nice to me. He protected me. So he was kind of like that song by Jimmy Dean, Big Bad John, that was popular in the 60s. Turned out Big Bad John was actually a guy who saved a bunch of miners in a cave-in.
Interesting.
So that was kind of a... my real-life experience kind of mimicking the song.
You're still a professor at Citrus College, right?
Yes, yes.
Have these stories affected your position or anything? I mean, what do your colleagues say, Bruce?
Some of my colleagues have taken the paranormal class, and they know about the book. Some of them have bought the books, and they're supportive, whenever a new book comes out.
So this hasn't backfired for you, has it?
No, it hasn't. That's what I was afraid of with the first book. That's why I held back. You know, I didn't mention any alien stuff in the first book, and not as much in the second, and then the third one, that's half the book. So I was careful to kind of hold that back, because I know that it's true that a lot of people will say, okay, ghosts, you know, that's okay. I guess I can kind of believe in that. But, you know, you start talking about aliens and you lose some people. And that's what I was afraid of. So I kind of held back until the last book, I guess. And but there's been no backlash. You know, I still teach the paranormal class. Nobody's asked me to step aside or retire early or anything. So
good.
And the students love it. So the students read the books.
Page 47, a little takeoff of Coast to Coast shows, Mel's Hole. Tell me about this.
Yeah, Mel's Hole. 1977, I was on a road trip with my friend, I call him Ernie in this story. And we were driving to, our original destination was to get to Salt Lake City, to Ernie's uncle's house in Salt Lake City. But we didn't, the first night we made it from Seattle to Black Pine Peak in Idaho. But along the way, we had stopped for lunch at a kind of a scenic overlook, just as we went over the Cascade Mountains in eastern Washington, and we turned onto the road to, I guess it was Yakima or whatever. And there was an outlook there, and we pulled aside. And I had noticed that whole day there was like these big black birds, and I thought they were either crows or ravens. I'm not exactly sure. I think they were ravens because they were pretty big. But I had noticed them that day. They were kind of like everywhere we stopped. And when we started the trip, I saw some. And when it was at this scenic overlook, I saw these ravens. And by the way, that scenic overlook was right there at Manistash Ridge, which is where Mel's Hole is supposedly, you know, at. And but I had no idea at the time. Anyway, so we kept driving, and we got near Boise, Idaho. And my friend Ernie was driving, and we had both fallen asleep. He had fallen asleep at the wheel, and I was falling asleep in the front seat, the passenger seat. And I woke up suddenly, like somebody woke me up. It was almost like somebody nudged me, and I woke up, and we were heading into the other lane, and a semi-truck was coming right at us, and its horn blaring. And so I woke up Ernie, and we said, okay, we got to pull off to the side of the road or something. This is ridiculous. We're going to get killed. So we took this little forest road. As it turned out, it was a forest road heading to we thought was a campground at Black Pine Peak in Idaho, in this wilderness area, total wilderness. And pulled off. We didn't get to the campground, but we just finally just pulled off by a clearing on the side of the road. And we were too tired to set up a tent. It was too dark. So we just slept in the car. It was very uncomfortable. And my conscious memories are very bizarre. I remember feeling paralyzed. I remember looked like people were around us. There were lights, strange lights and strange sounds. Those are my conscious memories. And this particular story, I matched my conscious memories with Ernie's conscious memories, because I contacted him. I said, do you remember that trip we took? And he remembered a lot of stuff, and he said, yeah, there was some strange, he agreed with a lot of stuff. There was all this strange stuff going on at this, on this forest road. And then I did a hypnotic regression with Yvonne, and I found out more that these people around the car were actually ETs, and that she, at one point in the hypnosis, she said, okay, you're in the car, what's the matter? And I said, well, I'm frozen, I can't move, and there's these lights, and there's this whooshing sound, and like the smell of rain, but it's not raining. And I, you know, there's like these entities around us, these, some are tall, some are short, they don't seem human. And she said, well, look next to you, what's your friend Ernie doing? And I as I'm in the hypnosis, I look, and he's gone.
He's gone? He's gone. Bruce, hold on for a second, we're at a break, we'll come right back and pick it up right there. We'll take your paranormal calls next hour with Bruce Olav Solheim. His latest book is called Timeless Trinity, an extraterrestrial and paranormal personal history. This, we're talking about things that have happened to him, and very strange things have happened to him indeed. We are back with Dr. Bruce Olav Solheim as we talk about his latest work, Timeless Trinity. It is the third in a series of what could be many, many more. Bruce, I'll let you finish up the Mel's Hole, then I've got to ask you about your Chicago experience.
Sure, yeah. So So I look over and Ernie's gone. And then the other things that came out of the hypnotic regression was a brief meeting that I had on the dirt road next to where we were parked overnight. And it was with a small being, and he had like some kind of a thing that looked like a clipboard, but it wasn't a clipboard. And then I related this information after I found out all this. I sent an email to Ernie and said, okay, I've written a story about what happened to us, and I shared it with him and added the alien stuff that I had recovered through the hypnotic regression. And he was very upset. He got very upset.
Really?
And so at first he said, well, if you would have told me that to begin with, I wouldn't have answered your original email, and I wouldn't have shared anything that I remembered. And he got really hostile, and I thought it was very bizarre. But anyway, I had trouble getting him to answer me after that. And then finally he sent me this strange email, Ernie did, and he wrote this, and it's in the book, word for word, what he said to me. He said, what if I want to put my alien abduction experience into my own book? It's kind of spoiled if you publish it first. Anyway, I actually do remember some details. In particular, I remember pretending to be drugged or out, but hearing the following snippet of conversation. I used to think it was from a dream, but maybe it was real. Where'd you find this guy? He's a bit of a squealer, eh? Said the first alien. You think he'd never seen pincers before, said the second alien. Then everything went black again. Oh, well, maybe I'll remember more of this later. You know, I wasn't sure if he was mocking me or joking or if he was serious, but he has not spoken to me or emailed me or returned my emails. I've sent several emails to him, tried to get a hold of him. He will not communicate with me at all.
Jeez, he just wants nothing to do with
it. I asked Yvonne about that, and she said that's actually quite normal for people who have tandem experiences, that when one of them faces the music, you know, that realizes what had happened, oftentimes the other one will do anything they can to cut that person off and just say it did not happen. They don't want to accept it. And then kind of to add the end to the story, I started digging around because I remember writing a poem in 1977 after this event, and I called the poem Visitors. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's about being selling out to the aliens, basically. And kind of put me in that position that somehow I had kind of arranged this maybe unknowingly, but somehow arranged this abduction for my friend Ernie, and it mentions pincers in the poem, which just when I read that, and that's what Ernie had said in his email, it chilled me to the bone. You know, it was like here's evidence, you know, of what I had written after the event. In 1977, so it was quite scary actually when I pieced it all together, and it's kind of a cool thing to be able to add all that stuff together. You know, you have a tandem experience, you get some of their memories, my conscious memories, and then add that to a hypnotic regression, and then a little bit of evidence from, you know, the original time period, that poem that I'd written.
Tell us about your Chicago experience.
Yeah, my Chicago experience, it was in January of 2019.
Oh, not too far. Okay.
This is a story of hubris. I guess there's always a moral to the story. But anyway, I got contacted. Actually, it was after I was on the first time, I think, with you.
That was June of 2019 was your last appearance, but I think you were on a little before that, weren't you?
Yeah, it was before that, yeah. So this was... I think I was on in 2018, I think, or, yeah. Well, anyway, it was after the first appearance, and this film producer guy contacted me, and he said, yeah, I'd like to test your, I want to do this documentary, and I want to test your abilities. It sounds like you're a high-functioning medium and psychic, and I said, well, I don't know. I'm just a professor. I'm a teacher, but I've had a lifetime of experiences. I'm kind of a paranormal lightning rod, I guess. And he said, well, I'd like to bring you out to Chicago and test you. And so he paid for the trip. And I thought, okay, he's paying for a trip to Chicago. But it was January of 2019, so that's not exactly the best time to visit Chicago. But I went there with my wife, and And he took me around to different sites around Chicago, in the north of Chicago. And these were sites where things had happened, you know, paranormal things had happened. And he didn't tell me in advance. He would just, and I didn't know what these sites were. And one place he took me to was in the south side of Chicago. And it was like he pulled into an Aldi's parking lot. And there was like an old post office on the other side of the street. And I got out, and I immediately started to feel something. I said, "Well, now, what is this place?" And he said, "The only thing I'm going to tell you is that it's a very dark place." And I could tell the neighborhood. It was south side of Chicago. It was a bad neighborhood.
Dark being like an evil?
Yes. And I started to see imagery. And this is usually what happens when I get to a place that's, you know, that connected. And I started seeing, like, scenes from the late 1800s. I started seeing buggies and horse and buggies and people in very dark clothing rushing around, a lot of kinetic movement.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was one man in a long overcoat, a bowler hat with one of those curly mustaches. I call it a Snidely Whiplash mustache. And he was just staring at me. Everybody else was moving and ignoring me, but he was staring at me. And it was very frightening. And the imagery went away, and I started walking around. There was an alley that I could walk up and down, and I approached this tree because I like to touch things that have been there a long time, and trees are a good source for me to try to pick up on what's going on. And I approached this tree, and as I was about to get to this tree, I felt like I was pushed down to the ground, not just knocked over, but pushed down into the ground. And as I was being pushed down into the ground, I felt completely helpless, and hopeless, and I started to see images of like men, women, and children that were being held like underground and tortured and killed, and it was an awful feeling. And I'm a big guy, like I said, and this force was so great that it drove me into the ground, and I felt like I couldn't get up.
Jeez, that's a weird experience.
My knee and my foot, and I finally was able to struggle to my feet, and I went back to the film guy, and who was just recording my audio at that point. He hadn't even got the camera ready, and I said, "We got to get out of here." And he said, "What happened?" And I told him what happened. He said, "I'm starting to feel something terrible too." And so we got in the car and we took off. And I said, "What is this place?" And he said, "Well, this is the site of the murder hotel, the H.H. Holmes, probably America's first serial killer, right there in the south side."
That's where he would kill a lot of people.
Yeah.
Oh,
the hotel was actually kind of between where the Aldi's was, in that alleyway between the Aldi's and the old post office, and he might have had underground tunnels. I'm sure he did as part of this complex. But, you know, maybe up to 300 people were murdered and tortured, and that was the whole purpose of this thing. The guy was eventually, you know, executed. And I got the title for that story, "The Devil in Me," because that's what he said when he was facing execution. He said that he was starting to look like the devil. But the moral of this story is that as a medium, when I go and do my spirit walks and connect with those that have passed on, and Anzar, this ancient alien mystic, I put a radar dish up, but it's usually safe because I'm protected. But here I was trying to impress this guy, you know, my pride, you know, saying, okay, this guy wants to test my paranormal abilities. I'm really going to show him what I can pick up. And I was kind of bushwhacked, if you will, or ambushed. And so I was hurt. I was physically hurt by whatever this entity was, whether it was a demonic spirit that drove him to, H.H. Holmes, or if it was H.H. Holmes' demonic spirit, I don't know.
These haven't been all fun and games for you then, have they?
No, that was a terrible experience, and I told him, don't ever do that to me again. Don't take me to places like that are that bad, that evil, and not give me more of a warning, because my radar dish, I call it my radar dish, was up. And I didn't have adequate protection against, I wouldn't have wanted to go there in the first place. Not without a lot more protection and maybe reinforcements, you know, because it was just too much. And I picked up on all the people who had been murdered there, and it was a horrible experience. And when I came back, I remember I went and taught my class when I came back, and I have several people in my class who are, you know, active. They're professional psychics. They like to take the class, and they picked up on all this negative energy from me.
Well, you must have been shaking like a leaf, Bruce.
It was terrible. It really shook me up, and I had terrible nightmares after, and they said, you know, you need some kind of a spiritual cleansing. You got attachments on you. The one lady actually got physically ill, left the classroom, and had to go out for air. And so I, you know, luckily I knew a Peruvian trained shaman who did a spiritual cleansing of me, and I felt better immediately. I felt like I weighed 1,000 pounds when I walked into her house, and when I came out after the spiritual cleansing, I felt light. I felt wonderful. So it was a very terrible thing, and I would not recommend anybody, you know, walking into that.
Warden, now, has your son been having some experiences too? Something's been happening to him?
Yeah, we saw, it was almost a year ago, it was March 19th last year, we saw a UFO together, which was pretty cool. And it was in the southern sky. We live in Southern California. It was in the southern sky, about 60 degrees up from the horizon, and it was moving erratically. It was very bright diamond shape, and it was moving erratically. I took a film of it, and I actually sent it to MUFON. But, you know, like most of these, they're kind of shaky handheld with the phone, you know, with the phone camera. But you can hear in the background my son and I talking, you know, he went through the same rationalizations I did. Okay, it's not an airplane. It's moving too erratically. It's not a satellite because it's moving too erratically. What is that? And I said, well, it's a UFO. And he said, yeah, I think it's a UFO. And then it stopped for a while, and it started to emit these, like, little lights off of it, like shooting off of it.
Like beams?
Yeah, like beams, but like in every direction from it. And then I went inside for some reason, and I came back out, and my son said, when you were gone, there was like this green light that came from it. And then it moved some more erratically, and then it disappeared. That was it. So I reported it, and I remember I asked my son, now, do you want me to add your name to the report? He said, well, I don't know. And I said, are you going to tell your friends? And he said, no, Dad, they'll think I'm crazy. That's what his. But now he doesn't feel that way. But at the time, he was so shocked by the whole
thing. Do you think, was he abducted too?
Well, we're not quite sure. I know that we've had entities in the house, and he's had experiences where he's felt there was somebody in the house, that he's seen shadows moving in the hallway. He has had bed shaking in the middle of the night, you know, just unexplainably shaking, covers pulled down. He felt like somebody was lying on top of his back at one point. And so he's had a lot of experiences. So he has the sensitivity that I have, which I probably got from my mother, who was very psychic, who got it from her mother. So I think it's just been kind of passed down the bloodlines there. So I had actually Yvonne did a hypnotic regression, just the beginning one, and it did reveal some things. Not
yeah, hypnotic. I mean, she's convinced something happened to you.
Yvonne, yes.
Yes. Something definitely happened to you.
Yeah, we've had several sessions, and so and her theory, of course, is the family connection. That's, I think, her next book is going to be about the family connection. So it's, in my case, it's with my son. And some people have asked me, you know, well, do you want to encourage that? I mean, isn't that, you know, with your son? And I said, it's going to happen whether I encourage it or not to understand it. So I think it's better for him to be equipped with knowledge and understanding than it is to just have these things randomly happen to him and he doesn't know what's going on.
We're going to take calls with Bruce next hour. If you want to share your own experiences or you just have a question for him, jump on board. His latest book is called Timeless Trinity, an Extraterrestrial and Paranormal Personal History. Are you glad this has happened to you, Bruce, or would you prefer that it never did?
I think it's both a blessing and a curse, but it's more of a blessing because I think I have a mission to help people understand and use whatever academic position and credentials that I have to, you know, to get the word out there and just try to figure out, you know, what the big picture is, try to piece together more of these pieces of the puzzle. So I see it as my life's mission now, you know, besides the, you know, taking care of my family and my, you know, teaching my students. I think that, you know, teaching this paranormal class, I think that it's actually more of a blessing than a curse.
You looked at PTSD. How did you tie this into the alien situation?
Yeah, I belong to CERO, which is the Close Encounter Resource organization headed by Yvonne Smith, And I came up with this idea, and I ran it past Yvonne, and she said I could do it. I did a survey of all of the members of CIRO, both here in the United States and in France. And I actually had the survey. Well, the survey was based on a well-established VA Veterans Administration PTSD survey called the PCL-5, which is based on the DSM-5, which is the American Psychiatric Association's definition and everything of PTSD. And anyway, the PCL-5 is something the VA uses to diagnose veterans who have PTSD. And I slightly modified it, so wherever it mentioned combat or military trauma, I said abduction or contact or, you know, that type of stuff instead. And so that's the only thing I changed about it. And other than that, it was the same questions. Well, I had very interesting results. What I found out is that of the people that belong to CIRO, who are all vetted, you know, by Yvonne and others in the group, you know, as to whether these are, you know, these are real experiences according, you know, to the best of their knowledge. So it's not just somebody making something up to whatever. I came up with the percentage of, I think it was 56% of the members showed clear indicators of PTSD.
That's huge.
Yeah, 56%. And then when I applied the criterion that they use for a provisional diagnosis, and this is for the VA, they use this to determine if they're going to get benefits or not. So it was 46%.
All right, Bruce, stay with us. We'll talk a little bit more about that and more about your abduction cases, and we'll take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.